طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. On May 4th of this year, an important event took place at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. It was a forum called Not Backing Down and dealt with a constant assault by pro-Israeli organizations to shut down pro-Palestinian voices. Ironically, which in fact made the point, there were serious attempts to prohibit this very forum from taking place by the Zionist lobby, including an unsuccessful lawsuit which emphasized the need for this forum to challenge this systematic campaign to silence the Palestinian narrative. This morning we feature voices from the UMass Forum, the third of our presentations of the event on This Week in Palestine. You will hear moderator V.J. Pershad, Palestinian activist Linda Sarsour, Temple University professor Mark Lamont Hill, and Pink Floyd's Roger Waters in a panel discussion which followed the speakers' presentations. You will hear that there were audience interruptions by pro-Israeli hecklers. We have edited out some of the interruptions, but have left others so that you can hear how the panelists dealt with this obstructionist behavior. So here is the panel discussion of the UMass Forum, Not Backing Down.
Okay, friends. There was a lot of debate about this event. And one of the shorthand ways in which this event was described, it was called a BDS event. Now, I've been involved in this movement for a very long time. And for years, one heard the statement, why don't the Palestinians do something nonviolent? For years, one heard, why don't the Palestinians do something nonviolent? Why are they always violent? So, Linda Sarsour, what is this BDS movement?
Thank you, VJ, for setting it up like that. And I think it's very important, which is why when I said on the stage that I'm a supporter of BDS and the tradition of the civil rights movement and boycott and divestment campaigns that happened way before there was ever a call from Palestinian society to engage in BDS, is because I am trained in Kingian nonviolence. And in fact, I will support any oppressed people in any corner of this world in their pursuit for justice by nonviolent means. The boycott, divestment, sanctions movement was a call from Palestinian society to people all over the world who are looking for ways to support the self-determination and the freedom fight of the Palestinian people. And so what the Palestinian people said to people all over the world, they said, if you want to support us, join us. Get your universities to divest from occupation, from settlements. Get boycott companies who profit off of the occupation of the Palestinian people. And it is a movement that has grown exponentially around the world. And I tell people all the time, the reason why I support students around the country who engage in these boycott and divestment resolutions on their college campuses is because I am proud of any young person who, number one, takes a stand for human rights, and yes, also of the human rights of the Palestinian people, and focuses their energy on powerful, non-passive, non-violent ways in order to bring justice. So I, as a non-violent activist, I support the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. And if you don't want people to support the Palestinian people through non-violent means, give me the alternative of what it looks like to support the Palestinian people. So for now, we're sticking with a nonviolent boycott, divestment, sanctions movement.
Mark?
Yeah. I agree with everything Linda said. And I think there's also some conversation about and debate about what BDS is calling for and what it's not calling for. Let me say a few things about what BDS is. One, BDS is, again, a movement that is committed to social justice. It virulently opposes anti-Semitism, racism, homophobia, transphobia, and any other form of inequality or injustice. That's a key point to mention. It is not a religious movement. BDS is agnostic on the state solution question. There are opinions within the BDS movement about one state versus two state versus all sorts of other political imaginaries. But BDS does not have a position on this. BDS is making three calls. One is a return to the pre-1967 borders. Two, and these aren't in any particular order, full rights and full citizenship rights and equality for what Israel calls Arab citizens of Israel, what Palestinians and supporters would call Palestinian citizens of Israel, that 1.8 to 2 million people who comprise the citizenry of Israel. And the third is the right of return. These are the three pieces of BDS. And again, BDS is a call, and this point can't be reiterated enough that Linda made. This is a call out of Palestinian civil society. Because the question for me as an ally is, why are you doing this? Well, because I support this cause, and this is the call out of it. Why aren't you looking in Crimea? Why aren't you looking in Tibet? Well, because there hasn't been a BDS call for it. And the reason, and BDS does not, one more thing, BDS does not target individuals. Although, in the tradition of South African anti-apartheid movement, it could. But BDS targets institutions, not individuals. It's institutions that are benefiting the occupation, benefiting the injustice against Palestinian folk. It's not individuals. So, yes, there are Israeli academics who might be inconvenienced, but the Israeli academic can still come to... For example, if we didn't win, the AAA, American Anthropological Association, did not win our resolution, but the Modern Language Association did, and ASA did, the American Studies Association did. An Israeli scholar can go to the American Studies Association conference. They're not banned. Israeli scholars are not banned from attending these conferences. They absolutely can, and they're welcome. So academic dialogue and engagement is not foreclosed upon. I want to talk to Israeli scholars. I want to talk to Israeli academics. The question here is, do we want institutions to benefit from these things? Because at the same time that I want an Israeli academic to have access, I also think about my colleagues at Birzeit, who can't go to... who can't go to a conference at the University of Haifa, who can't go to a University of Tel Aviv. They can't go to Jerusalem. They can't go to Jerusalem or Hebrew University of Jerusalem, excuse me. They can't attend these places. And so I'm thinking about academics that have to go through checkpoints and get permits. Yeah, I was trying to think an English word. That's why I'd be there too much. Trying to think who have to get permits to go to Al-Quds University in Jerusalem. So these are the things we're thinking about, but it's important to know what BDS is and also what BDS is not. Yeah.
I mean, this is absolutely a point that is never brought up, which is the academic boycott of Palestinian academics.
Right.
Not only in the West Bank, but in Gaza.
Exactly.
Where in Gaza University, people get even Fulbrights and can't come and take them. I don't know anything about American football, Dave, but I really don't know anything. But I did read up on your writings on Michael Bennett. I had to even look at his name, who is from the Seattle Seahawks.
Well, now he's on your New England Patriots.
Boo!
I'm an Eagles fan. Whooped your ass last year.
Well, the Michael Bennett story is a fantastic one because it shows the power of the person who opened tonight, and that's the great Angela Davis. Michael Bennett is somebody who had agreed with other NFL players to go on a trip to Israel. It was all expenses paid. It was a trip to Israel. It was going to be NFL players going to Israel. It looked like it was going to be a blast. He said yes without giving it a second thought. And then a newspaper article came across his screen, because it was sent to him by people who wanted him to see it, that talked about, that was a newspaper article from Israel that spoke about how by going on this trip, the football players would then become diplomats, emissaries of Israel itself, and that the trip was going to be closely prescribed so they would see what the government wanted them to see. And Michael Bennett saw this, and to his credit, he began asking questions. And he began posing questions to others who were going on this trip, asking, is this something that we want to be doing? And then he read a book, and it's called Freedom is a Constant Struggle by Angela Davis. And he started to think about Ferguson, and he started to think about Palestine, and he learned for the first time that activists in these disparate places have been in contact with one another, advising each other, speaking to each other, giving support to each other, giving tactical advice to each other about how to resist things like tear gas. And he started to put himself in the shoes of people in Palestine. He learned about murals in Palestine dedicated to people like Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown, and he felt an affinity for the Palestinian people. That was new. And then, and this is one of the benefits of playing in the NFL, he was able to get Angela Davis on the phone and speak to her himself. And that was a life-changing moment for Michael Bennett. And he was able not only to confront the reality of the trip, but then also speak to other NFL players as well who backed off of the trip as well, because they realized that they couldn't say, we are for Black Lives Matter in the United States, but somehow Palestinian lives matter less. They couldn't do it. And for Michael, I remember talking to him and him speaking about it being like a Dr. King moment when Dr. King said, you know, I could no longer raise my voice against violence in the urban ghettos when the United States is the greatest purveyor of violence throughout the world. It's that kind of moment where you start seeing these connections internationally in a way that, frankly, you cannot forget. And so that's the Michael Bennett story. And, you know, since that time, I mean, he's somebody who's, oh, this is the big part. I left out the punchline, which, not that it's funny, but what happened then was that he came out with a very public statement about why it was that he wasn't going to go. And he quoted 1968 Olympian John Carlos, who raised his fist on the medal stand. And John Carlos said, you know, there is no partial commitment to social justice. You're either in or you're out. That's right. And being in means you stand with the Palestinian people. And that became a huge news story throughout the world. And Michael Bennett was shocked at how viral this went, about hearing from people all over the world. But the end result of it, that what he said was, he said, it wasn't the hate I received, it was the joy I received of people who felt like they were actually visible and being heard. And that for him was a life-changing moment. And I just feel so incredibly lucky to have been able to experience that with him, because it just showed me, as if I needed any other evidence, that, you know, the power of us to create these bonds of solidarity throughout the world are more powerful than 1,000 armies.
Dave is being really humble, but he also wrote a book with Michael Bennett called Things That Make White People Feel Uncomfortable or something like that. So just want to make sure that you don't be too humble now, Dave.
Roger, you know, there is almost no important issue in our current moment that you haven't engaged in some way. I mean, you recently went to Ecuador, and against immense pressure from the government, you were able to go and see where Chevron, an American company, is destroying lands, forests, and the communities of the indigenous. I mean, it's, you know, it's extraordinary that People don't see the width of your commitments. But what I'd like you to talk a little bit about is the important role you've played in asking your, as you said, rock and roll fraternity not to play Israel. Could you talk a little bit about what you wrote in 2013 and then the work you've done since then?
What I wrote in 2013?
You wrote a piece in The Guardian, and that's where I got this lovely phrase, my rock and roll fraternity.
You might have given me a glance at it before you asked me this question. How am I supposed to remember something from...
It's what moderators do.
Okay. Bravo. I haven't had an enormous amount of success, I have to say, speaking to my colleagues, with the few notable exceptions. There is a shiver of fear that runs through the music industry if you mention BDS, certainly in rock and roll, most of these. I mean, some of them obviously are like, what's he talking about? Because we are divided into two groups of people, human beings, in my experience anyway. There are those of us who are the lucky ones who experience empathy with their fellow human beings. And it's what makes life worth living.
That's right.
Is that. There are other human beings who do not experience empathy with other human beings. Your president is obviously one. He has absolutely no idea what that word means. And in consequence...
Yes.
All right. There can be a smash. Which is one of the things, obviously, that makes him such an extraordinarily bad leader. But that's another matter. Within the music fraternity, naming no names, there are people as well who it's missing. They care about the bottom line. There's futile scrabble to maximize the bottom line. And if you say to them, yeah, you're going to earn $1 million in Israel, but what about human rights? What about the struggle of the Palestinian people over the last seven? Can you put yourself in the shoes of a Palestinian father whose child has just had his knees shot through by an IDF sniper? And they go, no. And they can't, which is a weird thing. So that's what we should be spending our money on. We should be spending our money on ways to discover why some human beings, developed without the spark of empathy, which is the only thing that, in the end, will bring joy to their lives.
I mean, that's the line in the poem, is this the life we really want? I mean, it's a question of humanity. What kind of human... it's an odd place we're in now in this conversation. I wouldn't say it's just in the United States. I think this is a global conversation. This place where the phrase anti-Semitism is used to quiet certain voices. When, you know, we all understand that they are real anti-Semites in places of genuine power, dangerous people, and so on. One of the questions that's come from the audience is, you know, do you think Ilhan Omar uses anti-Semitic tropes, for instance? It's a question. It's a question. It's come from the audience. I looked at it. I thought, this is interesting. Why is this an important question? Linda?
I think this is a very important question. We need to have an honest conversation about it. You know, one of the things that, you know, and Mark said this earlier when he was on the stage, you know, this idea of calling Mark or me or so many others, I can sit here for days and name other people who've been called anti-Semitic, is actually a disservice to Jewish people. Because what it does is... Now, you can sit here and say you vehemently disagree with us. Absolutely. We have different positions on Israel. We have different experiences. We come from different places. And we could have a spirited debate. And we can all go home and we can say we went to this event and we didn't agree with a damn thing anybody said. And that's okay. Because we live in a country. We live in a democracy. We all have different opinions. But when you start calling people like us anti-Semitic, you distract from real violent anti-Semitism in America. When anti-Semitism becomes black people and people of color who are the natural allies of the Jewish people, who also are black and Arab, let's be clear too, it is a disservice to Jews. And for our Jewish family who doesn't know how to feel about this disagreement on Israel, the question to ask yourself is this. There has to be or maybe not the question, but the distinction that has to be made between feeling uncomfortable and unsafe. We don't make you unsafe. We might make you uncomfortable. I'm not going to deny that. Now, so when it comes to Ilhan Omar, and I've been in this same position as Ilhan Omar many times, this idea of whether we are using tropes or anti-Semitic tropes. The question is, are there tropes being used against us? The way in which we have framed Ilhan Omar is through an Orientalist trope that basically says that we as Muslims are inherently anti-Semitic. So that we're anti-Semitic until proven otherwise. We are guilty until proven innocent. So when Ilhan Omar did the first tweet about it's all about the Benjamins, the scrutiny and the far reach and the... It was clear to me what she was saying. It was clear to a lot of people, including a lot of Jews, what she was saying. Dave will say it in a second. We cannot deny that in America, AIPAC and the Israeli lobby have influence on our government. That's just not something that is really debatable because it is very clear to me. So what I ask people sometimes is to give people a little bit of the benefit of the doubt. Ilhan Omar is a Somali refugee who grew up in a civil war and lived in a refugee camp, the largest refugee camp in the world. And so when people engage in things that you as a person may be offended by, and you have every right to be offended, you have every right to see something and feel a certain way, and your feelings are valid. The question should then be to understand. It shouldn't be a presumption of guilt that she was engaging in an anti-Semitic trope. Let's get a clarification from our sister. Let's understand whether or not she knows or has any idea that she could have been, in fact, using an anti-Semitic trope. So the reason why there was so much reluctance to join the conversation of whether Ilhan was engaging in anti-Semitic tropes put me in a situation where I said, I see a human being here. I see a woman who has fought for the working class people. I see a woman who is a victim of war. A woman who is in fact the American dream, who comes as a refugee and a black Muslim woman in hijab in an Islamophobic country and goes to the halls of Congress. That's the story of Ilhan Omar. And so for anybody to think that I am going to allow there to be a story that an anti-Semitic black Muslim woman went to Congress, well, you are mistakenly wrong. That is not going to be the story of Ilhan Omar. Ilhan Omar is a freedom fighter. She is a truth teller. And in fact, she is equal opportunity. She goes after the Saudi government. She went after war criminals like Abrams. She's all, you tell her where there's a fight for justice and you're going to hear her voice. Yeah. So I'll end by saying this. Let's dialogue. Let's debate. But to call us, including people like Rashida and Ilhan and folks on the stage, to call us anti-Semitic, in fact, is going to put us in a moment in history where something really bad is going to happen. And people are not going to know who the enemy is, in fact. And we're going to be distracted by the true groups of people in this country that don't want Palestinians to exist. They don't want Jews to exist. They don't want the black people to exist. They don't want any of us to exist. And in fact, our existence in America as black people, as Palestinians, as Jews, as trans people, as other marginalized people, just our existence is an act of resistance.
Yeah.
So, and I say this to people all the time, and why I have, and I don't like to say this publicly, because as a Muslim, I believe once you say what your good deed was, it gets erased. So I'm not going to get into the specifics. But I have shown time and time again as a leader in the progressive movement what solidarity looks like in action, not just in words, when it comes to solidarity with the Jewish people. It's there. I don't have to do it. I don't have to do it. I don't have to do it. But I do it because it's based on a quote that I have up in my office, in my bedroom. It's in my notebook right now. And it's by an Aboriginal activist, and it says this. If you have come here to help me, you are wasting your time. But if you have come here because you believe that your liberation is bound up with mine, then let us work together. And I believe that our liberation in America, as members of oppressed communities, is bound up together. But I will also sometimes make you feel uncomfortable just a little bit when I talk to my white Jewish sisters and brothers. Because yes, you are Jews and you are members of an oppressed community. Absolutely. 100%. And that is why we are seeing the rampant rise in anti-Semitism against Jewish communities. But we also have to recognize, and my Jewish white sisters and brothers, because there are black Jews and Arab Jews and all kinds of Jews, that there are moments where you can, in for a very temporary short second or two, benefit from white privilege as set out by white supremacy. That's all I said. And I don't say that to remove you from solidarity. I say that to you to recognize that you have a privilege that can easily be taken away from you in 1 second. And so that when we see right-wing Zionists, particularly those who are Jews and visibly Jewish, aligning with neo-Nazis, that the Jewish community has to stand up and say, that is not us, that does not represent us, and that our solidarity is with people of color, with Jews of color, with Palestinians, with Arabs, with black people. So that is why you will hear me make you uncomfortable for a second. Because your whiteness is conditional. Your whiteness is conditional. It is temporary and can be taken away from you in 1 second. But you know what is forever? You know what is always going to be here for you? This progressive solidarity movement that we have built is your home. And you belong in it. And it won't be whole without you. So don't sit at home trying to decide based on the right telling you there's anti-Semitism in the right and anti-Semitism in the left. There's discomfort in the left and there's ignorance in the left. And yes, there may be one or two or three people that are anti-Semitic in the left, but for you to try to equate the left anti-Semitism with right anti-Semitism leaves you without a home and leaves you vulnerable, and your security is important to the movements that we're a part of. So think about that. Reflect on that and know that these are the people, when the day comes, and we hope it don't come, are the people that are going to put our lives on the line for the most oppressed people, and that is also going to include our Jewish sisters and brothers.
Bravo. Yeah, my two pennies on Ilhan Omar is that anyone in this room who has not watched all 4 episodes of The Lobby, which was an Al Jazeera investigative documentary, should make sure that they go on the internet, find it, and watch them. Further to the Benjamins.
You know, when you were speaking, Mark, you talked about seeing very difficult sights in the West Bank. Like you, I have seen similar things in the West Bank. Of course, nothing approaches the situation of Gaza. Nothing approaches the situation of Gaza. And, you know, the question that I'm going to read to you comes from the audience. And it's extraordinary because rather than reflect on the extraordinary structural violence every day in Palestine, the question we got is, what do you say about the rockets that are being fired into Israel?
Okay. There are rockets being fired into Israel. That is an actual fact on the ground. I think, though, that it would be problematic and short-sighted and intellectually dishonest to not take a step back and look at the full context of Gaza, right? Because you can't look at one piece and disconnect it from everything else. No, I
Excuse me.
Let him answer the question.
That's your warning.
I'm not sure what I said that you...
Excuse me.
What did I say?
Excuse me.
I haven't said anything yet.
I've asked... Excuse me. Excuse me. Excuse me. I think that's probably already your third warning. So I would like you, because it's a ticketed event, to please leave the auditorium.
You know,
excuse me,
my brother. Can you do this? It's my brother right here. If would you mind allowing us to finish the conversation? I'd rather you stay if you can just not interrupt us as we talk. I understand you might disagree with me. The only thing I would ask is let me say it before you disagree with it.
Yeah, exactly.
Just you'll let me finish.
Please.
I appreciate your generosity.
Please.
But please allow me to finish. Please allow me to finish. I respect your point of view. I want you to be able to stay. I want you to be able to listen. I want to be able to have a dialogue, but we can't do that if the moment I grab the mic, you start yelling over me.
Excuse me.
Well, no,
I've
it's a
asked
panel.
A question. I've asked a question from the audience. Let him answer the question. Relax.
And so...
Relax.
Can I make an observation, Mark? I'd like to make an observation here. All of us, I'd like to make an observation here, and my voice is very loud. Yeah.
Please, go ahead.
I'd like to make an observation. It's very interesting to me that there is many people up here that are talking. But the most opposition, hold on a second here. The most opposition has been to a black man speaking in this room. So, hold on. And sometimes you just gotta put it out there. And as a Palestinian American, I am telling you that it's better for you to wait and listen and then disagree. Because you came here already with whatever. Give us a chance to speak, and in fact, give the black man a chance to speak in America.
I was gonna say that too.
See, if I say that, I'm sensitive. You know, I think we have to look at the context of Gaza, and when you look at that, first we have to look at, because one of the big arguments is, well, Gaza is controlled by Hamas, this is not Israel, and therefore any problems that happen in Gaza are Gaza's own problems. I think that's something we have to look at first. When Israel leaves Gaza, and Hamas is democratically elected. There is still Israel bordering Gaza by land, by air, by sea, the air electromagnetic sphere, the population registry. Gaza has never had a full moment, a single moment of self-determination. That's something that's important to note. Many of us who are critical of what's happening in Gaza are also critical of Hamas. I won't speak for everybody up here. I'm critical of Hamas. I think there's often a kind of thing where you have to almost ritually denounce Hamas to have any conversation about the occupation, which I think is problematic. But I do, I'm critical of Hamas for many. I'm critical of the Palestinian Authority.
Yeah, exactly.
In fact, Mahmoud Abbas asked me to come a while back to do a tour, and I was like, no, because I can't stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people and also support the PA at this moment in history, which is governing without a mandate. So I have to be consistent with this thing. I'm not avoiding the rocket question. I'm just trying to give a context for it. So when I look at the conditions of employment, when I look at the access to potable water, when I look at almost every measure of social prosperity that we use in the developed world, Gaza is in crisis. Gaza is, there are studies that say Gaza will be uninhabitable in the next 18 months.
Yep.
Literally uninhabitable. Well, so this is the context. And I think it's too often that we look at the question of resistance outside in a vacuum. So to look at rocket fire and not look at the violence of the occupation itself, to not look at the violence of structural deprivation, I think would be dishonest. This is not to say that every act is a righteous one. This is not to say that nothing is terrorism. This is not to say that nothing should not be a moral critique of anything. I'm not saying that. But to look at rocket fire as if these crazy Gazans, these crazy Palestinians are suddenly lobbing rockets into Israel for no reason, and to deny the fact that an occupied people have not just a natural and human right, but a right governed by international law to resist and to defend itself, I think is also something that would be dishonest.
I mean,
I know the applause.
Excuse me.
I think it's a great question. So the brother's asking.
I asked the event. Whatever UMass crowd, yes, please leave. I'm sorry, please leave.
All right, so
please leave. Thank you so much. 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 Thank you very much.
It's
thank you so much.
Yeah, so and so,
excuse me, I thought you were leaving. I thought you were leaving. Thank you. Yes, please continue.
Yeah, I don't want to belabor the point, but I think we have to have a... I do think we have to have an honest conversation about the question of Gaza. And I think we have to have a conversation also about what constitutes terrorism. And I think we have to have a conversation about the boundaries of international law. I think these are all things that are in the mix that we have to have. But I think, again, and this is the last time I'll say it, I think it's dishonest to have a conversation about rocket fire as if it's happening outside of historical context. I think we have to have a conversation about resistance, and until we do that, I think we'll always be able to frame Palestinians as operating irrational. Again, talking about Orientalist logic, framing the Palestinians as irrational, as barbaric, as uncivilized. When I don't see anything civilized about the occupation or about the structural deprivation that's happening right now to Palestinian people.
I mean, frankly, from my perspective, the United States government has the world's largest military and sells weapons at enormous volumes to the rest of the planet and drops its, let's call them rockets, on people from one end of the planet to the other. And I don't get any questions asking me about what about the American rockets.
And just to say, I find it remarkable how quickly we forget Operation Cast Lead from 2014. 400 children, according to the UN, being killed, 1,400 Palestinians being killed. It's just, once again, another example about whose lives are considered worthy of standing up in a crowded meeting and protesting, and whose weren't. I mean, you know what? You can say that all you want, but it doesn't change the fact that you are on the wrong side of history. I'm sorry. And it doesn't change the fact. It doesn't change the fact. It doesn't change the fact that the platform on which you are speaking is a platform made up of the bodies of dead Palestinians. That's the platform on which you are standing. Shame on you. Shame on you. You would be mocked out of my temple. I promise you that.
Okay. Let me ask a good question now. Yes, thanks a lot. My friend, I'm the moderator. I'm asking questions. I'm not sure who you are.
Bro, just write a question down. We'll answer it.
I mean, there's cards.
I promise.
You have a card.
I will personally take your question, but just write it down so we can have a conversation. Yeah.
Yes, write it down. Okay.
You're occupying the conversation.
Gotta remember that line for the next time. Wow. Yes. My friend, have some manners. Have some manners. Don't be so rude. Let me talk a little bit. Oh, God. All right. One of the interesting things that the organization Students for Justice... Can you ask him to leave, please? Because I think this is just... It's just rude. It's very rude. You can have free speech, but we have rules. Don't be so rude. You know what? It's also childish. Although, why should I insult children? Extraordinary. Yeah. Why should I insult children? Extraordinary. I wanted us to talk a little bit about the group called Students for Justice in Palestine. Now, it's an interesting thing that when young students on American college campuses approach the question of Palestine, the very name itself seems to irk people. You know, it's before they have an event that they're often asked to be closed down. So I've always found this very peculiar, this whole thing about we're against boycotts, we're for free speech, except if the group is called Students for Justice in Palestine, then the group must be closed down beforehand. I have a very sincere, nice question here, which is asking us, what options should student activists take when they are publicly smeared during pro-Palestinian advocacy?
You should know that we're with you. The three, four of us, five of us on this panel, all the Students for Justice who are here in this university, who are doing the work now, are taking the responsibility for moving this movement forward, who are trying to spread love and universal brotherhood with all our brothers and sisters all over the world, irrespective of their ethnicity or religion or nationality. That's what you should know. You are not standing alone. When I told my little story about being in Neve Shalom and finishing the show and going, you are the generation of young Israelis who need to stand up and make peace with your neighbors, it was silence. It was like a steel shutter going down. If I'd said that in an American university here, somewhere in the United States 10 years ago, there would have been a handful of you in here. Now you are many. We are many. Yeah. And we will overcome. Yeah. We will give our love to the rest of the world. We will not listen to the naysayers. That's it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Students for Justice in Palestine.
This is my love letter to SJP all over the country. And you should actually be honored when you are slandered. You should be honored when you are libeled. And I'm going to tell you why. Because you stand in a long tradition of freedom fighters in this country, many of them students and those of your age, who decided and made a choice to stand up even if they were alone. When we look at many of our leaders now, and you look at the Angela Davises of the world, you look at the Diane Nashes, the Ella Bakers, the Dr. Martin Luther Kings, the Congressman John Lewis's, and all these folks, you see them as old people. Seriously. Because we see them now and today. These people were 17, 18, 20, 21, 22 when they decided to stand up and organize. And did you ever wonder, with an opposition that is well-resourced, that they would decide to target poor college students? Like, you know what I'm saying? This is really something that has been beyond me. The lawsuits, the slander campaigns, the opposition from administrations, all of this just leads me to one conclusion. You are on the right side of history. And they may not, you may not be loved right now, but I will guarantee you, 20, 30 years from now, people will look back and say, that's how we got justice. That's how the student movement flared up across the country, and it was under the leadership of those who were courageous and brave and committed and joined Students for Justice in Palestine.
It's a difficult situation to remember being young. No, I'm just, you know, I'm just speaking atmospherically. Tell us a little bit about how you became a radical.
Oh, my God. Well, obviously, a lot of this, I think, is parental. My mother was radical. So there were always either Communist Party or Labour Party meetings in our house. And my mother used to drag me off to British China Friendship Association meetings at the Friends Meeting House in Cambridge, where I grew up. And I'll never forget her saying to me one day on the way home from one of these things, where I, as a six-year-old, would sit on the floor and watch grainy films of heroic Chinese People's Army fighting the puppet government, you know, and the 48 March and so on and so forth. And she said to me one day, you know where we were today, don't you? And I said, not really, Mum. And she said, we were in a place called the Friends Meeting House, which is where the Quakers meet and have their meetings. And I was none the wiser, of course. She said, the Quakers are a religious organization. They're a Christian sect, she said, but they do very good work. And although, as an atheist, I can't subscribe to their religious beliefs, they are very, very good people. And I've never forgotten that. And this, we have to understand that we may not share the same religious or other beliefs with other people, but what is important is to be on the right side of this question and any question that has to do with human rights and our capacity to empathize with and love our fellow human beings.
That's right.
Beautiful.
Great. Yeah.
I'm going to ask two of the students from Students for Justice in Palestine, Ananya and Sazia, to join us on the stage. They have a brief message.
My name is Ananya, and I am the president of Students for Justice in Palestine here at UMass. And before we leave tonight, I really want to take a moment to thank a lot of the student organizations that have supported us in these past few weeks, As a student on campus, we have been painted as dangerous to the student community, and that is extremely isolating and frightening at the same time. So with that in mind, I really want to thank UMass Black Student Union. Yeah. UMass Prison Abolition Collective. UMass Graduate Students of Color Association. And the Center for Education Policy Advocacy.
Assalamu alaikum. Hello. My name is Sazi Patel. I'm currently a member of the Students of Justice in Palestine group here at UMass Amherst. And I'm going to be the president of SJP next year. So for far too long across the world and on our campus, anti-Palestinian rhetoric has controlled the narrative through which we converse about this topic about Palestine, and no longer is being silent and complacent an option. And so this is why I'm standing in front of you here today and urging all of the students who will be here next semester to please get involved with us, join SJP, because we need people to continue helping us push this very important work forward. Really quickly give a shout out to all the seniors in our group, especially the dopest president, Ananya. Yeah. My words often fail me, and they will fail me today again, but your dedication and passion has been incredible, so I thank you for that. And I'm so excited. It's bittersweet because they're leaving and moving on to bigger and better things, and like I'm like super excited. But, like, the world is not ready for your power, so, like, let's give it up for them!
Bravo. We have about 10 minutes more, and I just couldn't resist asking this question because, I mean, it's an interesting matter in dialogues of various kinds. Only certain panels are portrayed as one-sided. It's an interesting thing. There are many panels at colleges and universities around the country, where, including here, when, for instance, Dennis Ross came to speak here, somehow the imagination is that people who are like that are schizophrenic, because they have both sides within them. And nobody seems to complain about that. But this panel was asked, why isn't there a pro-Israel speaker? Linda, why is there no pro-Israel speaker? Not that you organized the panel, but I think she might have a nice answer.
We are. We're all pro-Israel speakers. Everyone on this stage is a pro-Israel speaker as well. We care about the Jewish people and the Arab people who are living in Israel at the time, and we are pro those people. And we want them to have a proper life. It must be an absolute misery to be part of that supremacist apartheid state that exists at the moment. Can you imagine the misery of living like that? So we're for them. We want them to be liberated from the situation they find themselves in, as much as our Palestinian brothers and sisters who are suffering more. But this isn't bipartisan in the way that a lot of people would believe it is. I was sitting here just now, though, and I confess I wasn't worrying about them and their hurt feelings or their whatever it might be. I was actually thinking, here we are, we're sitting in this beautiful, warm room surrounded by a lot of beautiful, warm people, having a, by and large, good conversation about something that we all care about. In Gaza, they're dying. As we sit here, they are dying. And this is something that I cannot let go of when I'm sitting here in this cozy chair, knowing I'm going to get a glass of cheap white wine in about 10 minutes. Well, I hope so. But, you know, this is the situation is beyond the most desperate thing that any of us could ever imagine it. I care deeply about the people of Syria.
We love the people of Syria.
And the Rohingyas. We care about all oppressed people all over the world.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Linda?
So I would like to answer the question. Yep. Everybody here knows what my position is on the Syrian people. All oppressed people need to be liberated from dictatorships all across this world. So the question, Vijay, that you asked, unfortunately, doesn't actually always come from the right place. It wasn't people who were really concerned about a panel that was pro-peace or pro-Israel, pro-anything, really. It's actually a little more sinister than that. The question really is more about, I am not a whole human being. And our positions come from people who are so dehumanized that, in fact, in order for my opinion, for my truth to be whole, it needs to be validated by my oppressor. And so, if you want to hear another position that you did not hear on the stage today, you have the right to organize a panel with those other voices that you want to hear. And to be quite and very clear, there have been many opportunities and moments and platforms where those who have the position that would be perceived to be pro-Israel and anti-Palestinian have had more platforms than any of us in this room could ever afford.
Yeah.
And so I am here as a member of a marginalized community with a marginalized voice for far too long. But it's a new day and a new era, and we will no longer be marginalized. And what people are going to have to come to terms with, that if you in this country want to fight for social justice and you want to come to the, quote, social justice movement, when you get there, Palestine will be at the table.
Yes.
And we came here today, and Vijay said this very clearly in the beginning. This should never been a, I should never have to be in any space in America fighting for my right to speak about anything. We should have, and I came here today for a very specific reason. To do justice for the Palestinian people. I want the Palestinian people to know that there are Palestinians, generations of Palestinians in the diaspora that will never forget where we came from, that will never forget the blood that runs through our veins, and that we are here with a responsibility to keep Palestine alive, because the opposition wants nothing more than for us as Palestinians born in the diaspora to forget. But I will tell you right now, we will never forget. And our children and great-great-grandchildren will never forget until there is a free and liberated Palestine.
You have been listening to a panel discussion at the UMass Amherst Forum called Not Backing Down. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will hear us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.